to rein myself from rushing too quickly. My wife told me, "Don't worry. It's not like you have a semester time limit here. Just slow down. Little more, you know, bite-sized pieces. Don't try to get too much into every session." So I am going to spend a few weeks on intro to systematic theology, which is usually called theological prolegomena, the things we say before we actually say the things. But as I've said before, even in saying these things before we sort of focus on the doctrines themselves, we're already doing theology. We're already taking from the doctrines we will be talking about a certain sense of the shape of even the way we think as Christians, not just what we think, but the way we think. So today, I want to talk about two major paradigms or big picture ways of thinking and contrast these two ways of thinking with the Christian covenantal approach that we're going to be taking as we look particularly at Acts 17, beginning at verse 16, famous setting, Paul in Athens as he's waiting for the others, Silas and Timothy. We read Acts 17, verse 16. "Now while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. And some said, 'What does this babbler wish to say?' Others said, 'He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities,' because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took hold of him and brought him to the Areopagus," sort of the Oprah Winfrey show, "saying, 'May we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting, for you bring some strange things to our ears,'" which is exactly why they wanted him on the show. "'We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean.' Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, 'Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, "To the unknown God." I'm not going to miss him by a technicality. "What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they may feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he's actually not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, but others said, 'We will hear you again about this.' So Paul went out from their midst. Some men joined and believed, among whom also were Dionysius the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them." And so it has always gone as Christianity meets the Gentile world. The Jewish world was already sort of sharing some of the assumptions that someone like the Apostle Paul had. When Paul, for instance, talked about God coming at the end of history to judge and to redeem and raise the dead, that was no new news to Jews, at least to Pharisees. But it was a completely alien way of thinking to Greeks, whose philosophy was all about ascending from the body, from the realm of time and space through wisdom, philosophy, and achieving unity with the All One, unity with the divine. So two completely different stories here, and I have made the point that really our doctrines grow out of a drama. And even when liberal theologians, for example, stop believing the drama that gives rise to the doctrine, they still try to hold on to the doctrine for a while and say, well, the doctrine's sort of illustrated by the drama, not generated by it, because it didn't really happen, but it's kind of illustrated. These are myths that were used to sort of illustrate what we mean by these eternal truths. But that doesn't work in Christianity. It might work in Greek thought, where you have Aesop's fables, and every fable gives you kind of a moral to the story at the end. So don't be like, you know, or be like. And you have these universal ideas that sort of have mythological expression. For Christianity, if the drama isn't true, the doctrine doesn't matter. The doctrine is completely dependent on the drama having occurred. And that's why, you know, the resurrection is the place where Paul keeps going in his preaching. If Christ is not raised, it doesn't matter if it's helped you raise positive kids in a negative world. It doesn't matter if it has helped give you a little self-esteem. It doesn't matter if it's given you friends, positive friends. If Jesus isn't raised, this religion is a hoax. Now, you might, if Buddha never lived, Buddhism might be true, because it's all eternal ideas that work, generally, if you put them into practice. Christianity's not like that. If Jesus, this Jewish rabbi, wasn't raised 3 days after he was entombed, then this whole religion collapses. There's nothing that makes it salvageable. It's built on a lie. Christianity's the only religion that makes that claim. It's the only religion that says it could only be true if the resurrection actually occurred. If it didn't occur, nothing that Christianity says matters. And so paganism also moves from drama to doctrine to doxology to discipleship. But as the Apostle Paul says in Romans 1 and 2, it moves from the drama of the soul's exile, the myth of the soul's exile from the realm of eternal forms and ideas where it was thrown mercilessly into a body. This is Greek philosophy, which gives rise to a view of the universe as united, at least in the spiritual side of reality. Our souls are a divine spark of the One. And we have been incarcerated in the prison house of the flesh. And our goal now is to try to get outside of the realm of history and bodies and become one with that divine unity that we had before we were thrown into these bodies. Well, that's the drama that gives rise to doctrines like immortality of the soul, which is not a Christian idea. The eternal immortality, divinity of the soul is a pagan concept. We believe He will raise us from the dead. Not that our souls are the eternal part of us. Our souls are no more divine than our fingernails. Our souls are created right along with our earlobes. Also leads to a doxology, a certain kind of doxology, as we see here, as Paul speaks in the Areopagus, where we begin to praise the creature rather than the Creator. He underscores that much more, of course, in the first two chapters of Romans. That's what happens with this false drama of a world that is inherently evil because it is material, And we need to strive to transcend that realm back to a primordial, pre-material existence as divine souls. And so really, there are two fundamental ways of looking at reality, which is called ontology. This is the science the science of being is called ontology. The study of what's there to be known. It's the study of reality. What is there to be known? And epistemology, how do we know it? The science of knowledge. What is there to be known, and how do we know it? And our answer here determines our answer here. How we know something depends on what it is that we're trying to know. Trying to know how to fix a car is a little different from trying to know a mathematical formula. And both are very different from trying to know a flower from the perspective of an artist or from the perspective of a botanist. You can even know the same thing in different ways depending on what you're trying to get out of it. There are two ontologies that seem to have guided not only Western but also Eastern reflection the more we think about it. And Paul Tillich, the liberal existentialist theologian of the 1950s, wrote a fascinating essay that I've found very useful. Two types of philosophy of religion is the title of his essay. And he argued that basically in the world there are two philosophies of religion, two ontologies that really give rise to two whole systems of thought. One is overcoming estrangement. That's this myth of the exiled soul. Once upon a time, we all floated around in this netherworld of spiritual beings. We knew the realm of the eternal forms. We knew what time was. We knew what light was. Well, actually, we didn't know what time was because there was no time. We knew what eternity was. We knew what unity was. We knew what unchanging being was, because that was our existence. And so in this paradigm, you have the emanation of all of reality from the One, the way you have light emanating from a light bulb. So the closer you get to the One from which all things flow, you are in the realm of spirit, intellect, the eternal realm of unchanging forms. By forms, I mean the tree, not trees. The tree, of which all these trees are imperfect fallen copies because they're material. The intellectual tree, the perfect form of tree-ness. And then you have the realm of the soul, which includes passions or emotions that are sometimes dangerously associated with the body. And then you do have actually the body. And just as the light flows away from the light bulb, the further you get from the light, the closer you get to the body. And so the further you get from the light bulb, the further you get from unity. So everything that's great is spiritual, intellectual, eternal, unchanging. Everything that's sort of bad, or at least not even close to being as good as that, is material, sensual. So in other words, you're following your sense experience your outer eye, not your inner eye. You're following your observational skills in the realm of changing things instead of your rational, logical intellect with regard to unchanging truth. So material, sensual, temporal, and ever-changing. Plato said this is just the world of shadows. Plato said it's sort of like this. This is, imagine people are chained in a cave, and they're prisoners. They can't look behind them. They're just facing this wall, and behind them there's a catwalk, and there are people walking. There's a fire that has been built there to keep everybody warm behind the prisoners. There's this catwalk, and people walk back and forth on the catwalk with statues of things. There's somebody walking by with a statue of a cat. And they say, "Oh, look, a cat!" As they see the shadow on the wall. And another person walks by and they say, "Oh, look, there's a person walking up there on the wall." And of course not, it's just shadows. But people think that shadows are real. It's only when they kind of step out of the cave that they realize it is not the shadows that are real. And that was his view, is that this is the realm of shadows. So you have to turn your whole mind, he said, away from the realm of what is visible to your eyes. Turn your whole soul away from the realm of changing things and rise up back to the realm you came from of eternal, unchanging truth, so that you're not really learning new things. Education for Plato was not learning new things, it was remembering old things. Remembering eternal things that you have forgotten since you've been thrown into a body. Keep jogging your memory. Keep trying to rise up above the realm of changing historical appearances. So Plato didn't have much time for historians, because historians were just giving opinions. No knowledge of anything down here was true. It was only opinions, because it concerned the realm of ever-changing reality. Well, if something is changing, you can only have opinions about it. You can't have knowledge of it. You can only have knowledge of math and geometry and ethics and unchanging truths. You cannot have real knowledge in the proper sense of changing things, according to Plato. So obviously history doesn't matter. And why would you be an artist? The worst thing in the world you could be in Plato's Republic. Because Plato said, it's bad enough that a historian, for instance, studies copies of copies. Studies copies of the eternal realm. Imperfect copies. It's bad enough that a botanist studies copies, particular plants, rather than eternal forms of those plants. In other words, everybody should be a philosopher. But to be an artist, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to create copies of copies? That's what an artist does. An artist is copying this world. This is a copy of this world. Why would you copy this? You're stuck down here. Get out of there. Come back. This is all. Run away. Run away. This is, fly upward. Upward, O soul. It's a lot of the poetry of the West. Fly upward, O soul. You know, go up. Scale the heights. And so that's overcoming estrangement. That's one of the major paradigms. It's one of the major myths that guides gave rise to the doctrine. The doctrines that many of us assume, and even in churches, you know, you could talk to a lot of Christians about, for instance, doctrines like the immortality of the soul, and it's our default setting as Westerners. This idea that our souls somehow are the divine part of us, they came from another place than our bodies did. they are sort of that just inherently immortal part of us. And, you know, the eternal flame inside of us. That sort of idea is very pervasive, and yet it is very Greek. It's not just Western. Those of you who come from Eastern backgrounds, you know this is similar to Buddhism and Hinduism, and there are a lot of overlaps between overcoming estrangement in its Western and Eastern expressions. In Buddhism Hinduism, Maya is... It is this that you're supposed to deny as real. This is real. This is Maya. This is illusion. Well, Plato called it mere appearances. This is the real. So Plato really was saying things that are found really across the cultures. These two paradigms we're talking about here really cut across the cultures. Basically, overcoming estrangement is the paradigm associated with pantheism and panentheism. Pantheism, all is God, and panentheism, all is in God. Okay, well, what's the difference between these two? Pantheism just says there is no transcendence. God does not transcend creaturely reality. There's no difference between creator and creature. The creation is divine. And that was the view that the Stoics held, as Paul is speaking here in the Areopagus. And then there's a sort of more moderate view, more moderate paganism, panentheism, which says that even though there is a divine part of everything, it's more like the world is God's body, and God is the world's mind or soul. And so everything exists as an expression of God. Every leaf that blows is sort of God blowing the leaf. Paul could use this against them and then use the resurrection against both. So even some of your poets have said, in him we live and move and have our being. Which is pretty close to panentheism, but he used it against the pantheism of the Stoics. Then you have the Epicureanism of the deists in the arena there. You notice the two schools that he was confronting there were the Epicureans and the deists. The Epicureans were ancient deists. They believed that God maybe created everything and sort of got it all going and then walked away. This is what Luther accused Erasmus of being in Bondage of the Will. He says, You think, Erasmus, that God got all of this started while since the creation he has been off at an Ethiopian feast hanging out with the Epicureans. What does that mean? Well, that means this. This is the Epicurean view, and that's why Paul says he has determined where everyone would live. You think he's not involved in our lives? He's so involved in our lives that every time you call a moving van, God has already predetermined that all this was going to happen. God is involved intimately in every aspect of our lives. In him we live and move and have our being. But that's very different from saying we are gods or that we have divinity within us. And so Paul was facing both those who were confusing the Creator with the creation and those who were separating the Creator from the creation so that he wasn't seen as involved in providence and redemption. These remain the two alternatives that Christianity has to deal with when we are engaged in apologetics and evangelism. It hasn't changed. You know, it's not like there's a lot of inventiveness in the West. We have these two options, confusing God with the creation or so separating them that they don't have any relationship. And for the Bible, there is a relationship, but it's covenantal. The God who does not depend on the world, as Paul said to the Stoics, doesn't need the world for anything, but gives life and breath to everything else, freely willed to enter into a relationship with it. So that the fact that we exist and the fact that we can know God is not out of any necessity He has on His part, any need He has on His part. It is out of pure love, pure freedom. Didn't have to. He doesn't need us, but here we are. Why? Because He's liberal. Because He likes stuff He doesn't need. He's a little bit extravagant, if you think about it. How many colors of green do we need? How many shades of things do we need? How much stuff do we need? Not just that we manufacture, but that we actually have in creation. How many different kinds of bodies of water do you really need in a world? God is an extravagant God. He loves just doing stuff that He doesn't need, that He can live without. That's why we're here. That's why we exist, because of an extravagant God. And these views make us necessary to God's being. God needs us. The philosopher Hegel put it this way, repeating the medieval mystic Meister Eckhart, who was put on trial for heresy as a pantheist. The eye with which God sees me is the same eye with which I see God. God's eye and my eye are the same. When God is thinking, I am thinking. When I am thinking, God is thinking. If God did not exist, I would not exist. And if I did not exist, God would not exist either. And Hegel just repeated that and brought that into modernity, the modern era. And so we are very much, I think, in that kind of world today, whether it's Oprah and Dr. Phil and your sort of pop religion of the day, or it's the major philosophers of our day. Really, we're talking about this being the Stoics, really being in the driver's seat, confusing the Creator and the creation. So I think Tillich is absolutely right in his description of overcoming estrangement as this sense of our view of the world as something into which all spiritual essences, all spiritual beings have been entombed, and we need to strive to get out of it. We need to strive to transcend it. We need to try to get away from the realm of the flesh. When you hear Christians, for instance, talk about the flesh as this, being inherently evil, or we go on sinning because we still live in fleshly bodies. How many of you have heard that? That's this. That is a Greek way of thinking rather than a biblical way of thinking. So all along the line, we'll see how the Bible transforms these categories, even uses a lot of the same language as the Greeks, and sort of dynamites it from within. Very, very subversive. The New Testament is very subversive in the way that it continues. In fact, that's one reason the philosophers of the day said, just would you not use our words? Don't use our words anymore. You're totally destroying our culture and our philosophy. They went on using them anyway and just filled them with new meaning. And in the process, really brought a great challenge to the whole Greek worldview. And we'll see why Christianity did that as we go along. Basically, this paradigm of overcoming estrangement can be seen across the religious landscape, particularly in Buddhism, Hinduism, and extreme forms of Jewish, Christian, and Muslim mysticism, Sufi Islam, for example, all kinds of Gnostic versions of Christianity, extreme versions of Christian mysticism. I had a when I was doing my doctoral studies, they had one of the most popular lecturers on campus at Oxford was a former evangelical. In fact, he had been one of the leaders of InterVarsity in Britain. And Keith Ward. And he was showing or arguing that at the mystical edges of every religion, you basically have the same thing, the same doctrine. If we can just get all the mystical elements, aspects of all the major religions together, then we can have this one religion that we really need. Just the packed crowd. He always had the packed crowd. Everybody loved listening to this. And he succeeded in getting a lot of us together because a Muslim, a Jewish guy, and a Roman Catholic and I went out to the pub afterwards to call down fire upon this man. So, no, to really call, to hope that he would repent, but at least I was, because what he was doing was essentially making his white Northern European religion the dominant religion over all of these historical faiths that have rationales for why they believe different things. And basically this is Keith Wardism. And so we're all just benighted people who can't get along with each other. You know, we just can't see that his religion of happy, mystical, sort of Oprah Winfrey, you know, why can't we all get along? Just let's blend all of our differences into the unity of spirit and feeling and experience. Get away from all these dogmas that distinguish us from each other. That kind of thinking is very close to overcoming estrangement. So when you hear that kind of language, what you're really hearing is, let's get away from dogma, which concerns this realm, things that happen in history. When you think about it, that's what makes Christianity a little acerbic. Gives it its rough edges. Not its eternal principles, but its historical claims about things that happened. It might share a lot of eternal principles with Islam. You know, you look at the law, for example, in Islam, Judaism, and Christianity sound a lot alike when it comes to the moral law. I've done a little bit of work on that. It's really interesting how they all affirm natural law going all the way back to Adam. Everybody is born knowing the law, and they should be held responsible for knowing that law because they were born in a covenantal relationship with Adam. Islam, Judaism, Christianity. Where we really have our differences is over Jesus being bodily raised the third day. You know, it's the realm of history. So if you don't even consider this important, obviously you won't consider dogma important, doctrines important, as long as we don't violate our eternal principles that we all agree on. But as I say, Paul says, eternal principles, schminciples, forget it. The whole thing is just goofy. The religion makes no sense whatsoever. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. The Epicureans are smarter than religious people. If Jesus isn't raised, it all hinges on something here, and that's why it was foolishness to Greeks. This, everything hinging on something that happened here, made absolutely no sense. All right, we'll pick up there. Well, first of all, let me ask you, are there any questions? And once again, I'm watchless. Are we out of time? Oh, okay. Yes.
So, for example, there's a Christian writer by the name of Watchman Nee. Where is he?
Great question. The question is about Watchman Nee. Yeah, Watchman Nee argued that the human person is made up of three levels: body, soul, and spirit. trichotomy. Now, not everybody who's affirmed trichotomy has been Greek in their philosophical inclinations and everything else. But this is the Greek perspective. When Paul says, the Apostle Paul says that when he speaks of the fleshly mind and the spiritual mind, first of all, he says the fleshly mind. He doesn't say the flesh. He says the fleshly mind, which is a confusion of categories if you're a pure Greek philosopher. And he just loves stirring up those, you know, confusing those categories. Just as John did when he said, the Word became flesh. Well, they knew what a logos was. They knew what sarx was, flesh. But the idea that something divine became flesh willingly was absurd. So Paul, too, was using these concepts of spirit and flesh, not to contrast our spirit and our bodies, but to contrast the Holy Spirit and the age to come with this present evil age under the dominion of sin and death. And even New Testament scholars, liberal New Testament scholars like Rudolf Bultmann, who kind of was very Greek in his contrasts, says that that's what Paul is doing there. So it's very different from Watchman Nee's approach, where we have a lower self that is bodily, a higher self that is soulish, and then a higher self yet that is spiritual. And in some presentations of this, you actually have a new spirit given to you in regeneration. How many of you ran into that? You find it a lot in Campus Crusade presentations and so forth, that you're given a new spirit in regeneration. We have bodies, we have a soul, but we're given a brand new spirit in regeneration. And Reformed people understand these passages just as a rule to teach not that God gives us anything new in the new birth. We don't receive anything new in the new birth. Well, then why is it called a new creation? Because everything we are is new. We're not given anything new. Everything that we are is still what it was, but it isn't the way it was. And so this affirms creation. Creation, there's nothing wrong with creation. It's not that we don't have the right parts. It's that everything that we are has been corrupted by sin. And so the goal of grace is to liberate us to be the creatures we were meant to be, not to make us something other than what God made in the first place. This still has very much a let's transcend our physical existence. Let's transcend our creatureliness. And a lot of us, you know, we're familiar with this growing up. Let's just try to, if we could just get away from worldly things and just focus on spiritual things. You know, monasticism arose out of this. We could just get out of the world and Luther said he thought that was the problem. If he could just get away from secular concerns, he could really win this victory over the devil. And he said, doggone if I didn't go into that cell and drag in that rascal with me. Yes. Good question. Yeah, it's biblical theology as a sub-discipline in theology really came about in the 19th century, and it arose really out of 17th century federal or covenant theology. In fact, a lot of the liberal pioneers even of biblical theology in the 19th and 20th centuries will point out Coxeus, Olivianus, and other of sort of our Reformed forebears gave rise to the subdiscipline of biblical theology, but it really became its own subdiscipline in the 19th and 20th centuries, partly as an alternative to systematic theology, to undermine the doctrines of the Christian faith in favor of, what the Bible really teaches. And so there's a Reformed version of this, conservative Reformed version that grew up around especially Gerhardus Voss at Princeton Seminary and others in the early part of the 20th, the end of the 19th and early part of the 20th century. So that's what we mean when we're referring to biblical theology as a handmaid to systematic theology. We're talking about what Gerhardus Voss, Hermann Ritter Voss in the 1950s, Meredith Klein, and others have done in trying to show both how the doctrines of the faith fit logically together, systematic theology, and how they are revealed organically from Genesis to Revelation. We don't have the Trinity revealed in Genesis the way we have it revealed in John, for example. So showing that organic development is what biblical theology does. Yeah, we'll focus specifically on this question of, anthropology, the doctrine of man later. But, soul and spirit are two distinct parts of who we are. Otherwise, the passages that speak of us being present with the Lord even when we die have no meaning. Some Reformed theologians like Berkauer in the Netherlands and others, I think, have gone too far in reacting against this Greek scheme by saying that when we die, we're dead. It's just exactly what the materialists say. And then we're raised on the resurrection day, just as Christians have always said. But there is no intermediate state. We don't go to heaven when we die. We just die like a dog. And then are raised because there is no distinct soul, just the body. And there is a lot more favor toward that view today than ever before because of science, neuropsychology, and so forth. I think that, there are all kinds of, we have to beware of stepping into things that we don't understand and areas where science may actually help us understand a few things that Scripture sort of hints at, but we haven't really thought through because we're standing in a different stream of science. Whatever our conviction comes down to, I don't think that we can deny an intermediate state. There are just too many passages that indicate that we are with the Lord even though our bodies lie rotting in the grave, and that one day our bodies will be raised. At the same time, those same passages teach that we are not fully happy, fully liberated until our bodies bodies and souls are reunited. And even though we are body and soul, it's better to say we are body and soul than to say we have a soul. Because that assumes that we, the real we, is the soul and it has a body. That's no truer than saying the body has a soul. So we're no more truly body than we are soul. The real we is embodied soul and souled body. No, our soul is immortal only if God chooses it to be immortal, like our bodies. Only because of a gift of God. Only because God says, going to grant immortality. That's why Paul says that the gospel has brought immortality to life. To light. Well, no, I thought Plato did. No, the gospel has brought immortality to light. No immortality before the gospel. only as a gift of grace, only because Christ has come that our souls can be no longer kept in this holding tank, Gehenna, or shadowy place where Jews thought that people went, but that they go into the presence of the Lord, because Christ has been raised from the dead, but not yet resurrected. Sam, did you have a question?
Yeah, does the scripture use soul and spirit interchangeably? Does it not
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and there are passages we'll look at when we get there where trichotomists, people who believe that we are body, soul, and spirit, will argue on the basis of two important texts, and we'll look at those texts and see how they're they use spirit and soul interchangeably. Sometimes even body. Right. Well, that's interesting. There are two different approaches to Plato. The view of Plato that you get from the Republic, from the Timaeus, where he really focuses on the difference between flesh and spirit. He just says the cause of all strife, of all wars, of all disagreements, of all frustration in the world is the body. So we have to turn away from the body and everything contaminated by it with the whole force of our soul's being. He's very clear about it. On the other hand, there are places where he says that it's the copies, however bad the copies are, they point us to, they trigger our recollection of the eternal realm. They aren't in themselves evil. And so we can use that ladder to climb up to the eternal things. But Plato just never lets the things down here be good. They're only good in a very, very diminished degree, because they share in the goodness of the eternal form. Okay, well, we'll pick up there next week, and we'll look at the other paradigm that shapes contemporary thinking.